Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation did not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. This month, John Norquist, President and CEO of the Congress for the New Urbanism, spoke in Evansville. Norquist talked about urban design and how design can create commerce and benefit a city's economy. Norquist also talks about school choice and the importance of the sites where schools are located.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back home in Indiana. I lived in Rushville and Muncie when I was a little kid and enjoyed my time in Indiana very much. What I'm going to do is go right into the images, so if you can get the lights down a little bit, whoever's in charge of that, so people can see it. I'm going to have two speeches today. One is about urban design, coding, zoning, street dimensions and so forth, and then I'm going to talk about school choice in the second half of my remarks in more detail. This Congress for the New Urbanism is a group with 3,000 members. We have about nine, depending on what time of the month, about nine staff people, and we work all over the country and all over the world. I was just in Israel last month at a design institute that our colleagues in Israel set up, where we had five Jewish and two Arab mayors together working on design problems. And if it was based on that meeting, all the problems there would have been solved, because they all liked each other very much. Anyway, now I'll get into things here. Evansville is an important city. It's been a very successful river city. It also has been an important manufacturing city for a long time, and this would be a picture that would be like the glory story for Evansville. But this is how most of America has been built for the last 40, 50 years, what we often call sprawl. And there's really two ingredients to sprawl. There's others, but there's two I want to mention from this picture, major ingredients to sprawl. One is separate use zoning, where you highly separated use zoning, where you have residential in its own pod and retail in its own pod and offices, nothing ever together. And you've all seen this on the edges of Indianapolis or in outside of Evansville or outside of Rushville, for that matter, where you have this high degree of separation. The other thing you see here are the streets. The streets are only for one purpose, vehicle movement. Traditionally, throughout human history, when you had a road in a urban area, in a city, it had three purposes, movement, economic, the marketplace, and social, the public square, Main Street. And that goes back to the ancient Romans or Greeks or whatever. But in the post-war period, particularly in the U.S., more so than in other advanced industrial countries, our federal government in particular, but also by extension all of the state DOTs, started just doing roads that had to do with movement. And the goal of the roads was to increase mobility, reduce congestion, and all of the other purposes of the road were left out, at least in terms of roads that the feds and the state were willing to pay for. To understand separate use zoning, Leo Krier, who's an architect from Luxembourg, but he's the chief advisor on architecture to Prince Charles in London, although he lives in France, of course. He uses the analogy of a pizza. A properly built city would have the ingredients of the pizza put together, baked properly, and it'd be delicious and you'd love it. But sprawl is like you didn't put the ingredients together. You put them out on your kitchen table, the cheese, the flour, and so forth, and you don't bother cooking it. You just eat it. And it's not as good. And that really is true if you look at real estate values as they've evolved. And immediately after the war, that kind of separate use zone suburban sprawl had a premium. People maybe reacting to the depression and the war and the dirtiness and the lack of repair in the old cities and looking at sort of a brave new world thought that was better. But if you look at market trends for the last 10 years, the Urban Land Institute, which is a developer organization, has put out a study that increasingly shows that you get more value with urban-type development, more value per acre, more value for the investment. And so a city properly put together has mixed uses. It has reasonably sized streets. This happens to be the Wicker Park neighborhood in Chicago, where you have Milwaukee, Damon, and North Avenue come together. Those of you that are familiar with Chicago might have been there. It's just packed full of restaurants, artists. The floors above the stores are mostly residential, but they can be either. The zoning code allows either residential or office. Retail mandatory on the first floor. Sidewalks big enough so people can walk three or four abreast. And there's room for a couple row, or for at least one row of tables in front of a restaurant. The streets have one moving lane in each direction with parking all day, even at rush hour, because the top priority of the street isn't vehicle movement, and the purpose of the public policy isn't just to defeat congestion. So there is congestion, but not just of vehicles. There's congestion of people, of money, of real estate value. All those things are, all those kinds of congestion are there. And so by the standards that are used by the federal government and all of the state DOTs, all of the streets in this very successful neighborhood are rated at F for failure under the classification scale they use. A is when the vehicles can move at high speed, uninterrupted, and F is when there's congestion. But if you're a pedestrian, this street would be an A, and the other kind of street I showed you earlier would be an F. And another thing that's happening now is markets are starting to be attracted to transit stations. And Evansville hasn't had streetcars for a long time, I think since the mid-1930s. This is in Pasadena, California. Remember the little old lady from Pasadena? And, you know, Pasadena did the whole freeway thing and ripped out the red cars and the gray cars and all the transit they had. But it's coming back now, and this is a transit stop with apartments packed around it with retail in the right places and great, great real estate success connecting people to job centers both in the city and the suburbs. Now, for those of you that are conservative and have been getting uncomfortable with my conversation, you know, praising transit, criticizing highways, I want to try to help you to relieve yourself a little, feel better. This is a drawing that my building inspector, who was a big reformer when I became mayor in 1988, this is a drawing that he did to show what he thought our permitting process looked like to developers. And I think he was right. And I interviewed developers who were doing all their housing development in the suburbs. I brought them into my office. I said, why don't you do stuff in the city? You know, the city had been 740-some thousand people at its peak in 1960 after annexing a whole bunch of land and then having the annexation, of course, prohibited by a Republican governor and two Republican houses. Now you know why I'm always not cheering on Robert, Republican takeovers. They froze Milwaukee's boundaries so it couldn't grow anymore. So the population was declining and declining and declining. So I started to ask all these questions. Why? Why is it declining? And why aren't people developing here? And there are a lot of answers, and one of them has to do with schools, which I'll get to later, but one of them was permits. So I bring these developers in. I say, why don't you want to build houses in Milwaukee? And they say, well, we don't do low-income housing. I said, I didn't ask you if you do low-income housing. I asked you why you don't develop housing that you would sell to people in Milwaukee. And they said, oh, your regulatory process is the worst. And so I heard that. I heard of a lot of other stuff. Some of it was, kind of ugly. And I didn't, I could reject that part of it. But I listened to them about that. And we did change our regulatory process. And the same people told me 10 years later, ours was the best, better than any suburb. And so we did this drawing to show our process, which we really simplified it. We really did do a one-stop shopping, except for, of course, the plumbing code, which is controlled by interest groups that are beyond control. That always was usually the last stop in the permitting process. And we had four plumbing inspectors, and they had their own bargaining unit in Local 75 of the plumbers. So, and I really always enjoyed that process, Mayor, as you do as well. Anyway, so it helped a lot. All of a sudden, we made it easier to get permits. I kept trying to get downtown housing, and my Department of City Development people would say, well, we'll have to provide subsidies. And the developers say, well, you'll have to provide a subsidy. So I had a guy come in. He wanted to do a 28-story apartment building facing out over Lake Michigan on Prospect Avenue. And the lobbyist, one of these guys who hung out at City Hall constantly, he brings in this developer who had been a suburban developer, multifamily and single family, brings him in, and he says, yeah, Mayor, we came in here. I brought Dennis in because I wanted to see what we could get. We're going to talk to you, and then we're going to go down to the city council, and we're going to see what we can get down there. I said, well, I can tell you what you're going to get. Nothing. He said, but there's a gap. I said, no, the gap's between your ears. You're going to get nothing. If you have to be bribed to build a 28-story apartment building with a view of Lake Michigan, then we're not going to do it. But there is one thing I'll give you, real fast permits. And we hadn't done any of this reform yet, so I really didn't know what I was talking about. I made a promise that I really couldn't deliver on, but I didn't know it. See, so it wasn't dishonest. I just didn't know. I said, look, I'll get you every permit you need for this building in 3 months or less. And the developer said, wow, I'll take that. And the lobbyist's face just went, because his work was done, because the guy shook his hands and said, we're going to do it, 3 months or less. All right, so it took 4 months. And I had to go sit in the plumbing and beg these guys and tell them, I know you're more important than I am. I understand that. But we got to do this. But anyway. So we sped up the permitting process. We united all the stuff so that you didn't have to go through hell, go through one process and another process. We did that, and we did it with less personnel, too. That actually was a key part of it, that you could actually do it better without as many personnel as you had before. Another one that was really a blockage for redevelopment, particularly of old properties in the downtown, was that there had been a parking ordinance put on the downtown back in 1961 that required lots of off-street parking. And these are 19th century buildings. That's a 19-foot frontage on a building. That lot was empty from 1966 or whenever the building burned down. It was empty all that time because the code would have required 7 parking spots on a 19-foot frontage that where the lot only goes back about 70 feet. So you'd never build anything. Nothing could ever be built. So we changed that ordinance, and right away, there it is. There's the building filling in the empty tooth. So you should look at those off-street parking ordinances, Mayor, and get rid of them. You don't need a parking minimum. There shouldn't be a parking minimum. That should be between the property owner and whoever they're renting or selling to. You do not need parking minimums. Allow parking on the street instead. That's what retail really needs, is parking on the street. Another thing that happened in the 50s, there was a setback put on a lot of our streets, 50-foot wide streets, the engineers wanted to make them into 72-foot streets because that was state of the art. So this street, National Avenue, 3.5 miles long, every building on the right-hand side of the street became a non-conforming use. You'd buy a building, you'd want to buy a building, you go in and get a do a title search, and you couldn't get a clean title. You own a building, you want to get bank financing to repair, do major repair or to get a building permit. It was a non-conforming use. We basically sentenced all of the property on one side of the street to death, property death. And it was property tax-based suicide by the city. And so we changed that. So then we changed it so that if you wanted to, if a building failed or for some reason was gone, you want to build a new building, you built it up to the street line, you'd need a variance if you wanted to do it wrong, the way it was before. If you wanted to do it right, you needed a variance. And we also stopped just believing what everybody says. We had a mall fail, Capitol Court, and everybody said, well, that's the end of that. Well, malls failed all over the country, even in some pretty wealthy places, because you know what? Malls don't work very well. It's not the wave of the future. Almost nobody in the United States is building interior-facing malls anymore. Almost nobody. I know they're building one in Syracuse, New York, but the state of New York is putting $700 million of subsidy into it. So that tells you where malls are going. They're a socialist project at this point. So anyway, we decided that we would redevelop, we would ask the developer, the landowner, to redevelop this Capitol Court Mall and just put streets through it. We helped with the streets. He doesn't have to pay for all the streets. But we didn't help with buying, we didn't help with building, capitalizing the buildings. We weren't his development partner or anything like that. And when he came, when Walmart wanted to be his tenant, that was the only big department store he could get, said, fine, is Walmart a problem for you? No, it might be a problem for the retail union, but it's not a problem for us. And eventually, after a little turbulence at the city hall, we got a Walmart on a street with a sidewalk, Hope Avenue. It has too much parking, 3 per 1,000 square feet of retail space. But Walmart used to require 5, and now they're willing to do stores with only 1 parking spot because they figured out they weren't in the parking business. They're in the retail business. And Home Depot, same thing. On Halsted Avenue in Chicago, just north of Diversey, the Home Depot, 2-story building, no visible parking. There's some through the alley and underneath the building. Escalators. If you took Home Depot off that store and put Nordstrom's on it, would look perfectly natural. Home Depot, in the right location, will do an urban store. They'll do good architecture. The big boxes actually are department stores. And if you want to redevelop downtown Evansville, talk to some of them, like Target. This may be the best location in the Evansville metropolitan area for a Target is downtown Evansville. Another ordinance that really had a negative effect, it was somewhere in northwestern Ohio. I don't know if it was Lima or Fostoria, but Don Shoup has been researching it. He's an economics professor at UCLA. Anyway, he wrote a book called The High Cost of Free Parking. It's got just packed with information that everybody in your public works staff should read. Somebody in Ohio, an alderman, walked into the city planner and said, how much parking for a bowling alley? And the planner should have said, I don't know, and who cares? But instead the planner said, 5 spots per lane. Okay, now do you remember? You'd be Main Street, you'd have the hardware store, and the coffee shop, and Floyd's barber shop, and then the bowling alley. Well, those days were over because once this thing started in the late 50s, it spread like topsy all through the Midwest. And that's how you ended up with these bolorama, bolero, all that stuff, giant parking lot with a box in the middle where the bowling alley was. And you look around the Midwest now, and you see this everywhere, Paradise Lanes with the big empty parking lot with the grass growing out of it. That's because of that zoning interference, because they decided that they, you know, five spots per lane. There's only four bowlers. What do you need five? The pin spotter gets one? I mean, okay, but don't be depressed about this. I didn't just come here to badmouth Sprawl. You can actually fix it. This is Cisco's headquarters in Santa Clara County, California. And, you know, it's a typical office park, and that's it. A parking lot with some boxes in it, and the people, the way the real estate market is so screwy in the Bay Area that, you know, people are commuting 100 miles because there's no housing anywhere near it. So Cisco did a, they're doing a very logical thing. They're lining their parking lots with nice urban condos and apartments and giving their employees first crack at it. And so they'll gradually turn what was just an ugly office park into a real place. And so you can retrofit this stuff. It's really not that hard. Another big problem is schools. And I'll get to the school choice a little bit later, but just school siting. The National Association of School Facility Planners, they have a standard of 30 acres for high school, 20 for middle school, 10 for grade school. Okay, now Wrigley Field is on 8.7 acres. So the minimum size for an elementary school is 10 acres. That's about four square blocks. Why? Because they were raising standards. That's what groups do. They raise standards. You know, like the funeral directors in Wisconsin, they require junior standing in college before you can go to embalming school. You know, just in, you have to be really well educated when you handle embalming fluid, apparently, before you even learn how to handle embalming fluid. But that's what all these groups do. So all over the country. Now, in Arkansas, and this I actually think Bill Clinton was a good president, but while he was governor, you know, he was always one of these guys who wanted to upgrade everything, upgrade standards. You'll notice in Arkansas, 35 acres for a high school. They're not going to have bad high schools. They're going to make them on 35-acre lots instead of 30. But what you end up with is there's no space for the schools in the middle of town where the kids could actually walk to school. And so you end up with a phenomenon of these schools way out in the countryside. You got to bus the kids out there. If they're in high school, you have to provide parking for the kids because they start driving to school. And so we're changing that. Working with the Green Building Council, which we put out a new product called LEED-ND, and we put in there a new standard, a competing standard. These are maximums, not minimums. An elementary school cannot be bigger than on a lot bigger than 5 acres, 10 acres for a middle school, and it can't be any bigger than 15 for a high school. But if you want to put a high school on a half acre, go ahead. Some of the best high schools in New York City are on a half acre or less. My son's high school in Chicago, Parker, which is one of the best ones, is on a site that's less than 2 acres. Here's a high school that was in Andersonville, Indiana. Okay, that's what they replaced it with. You know, which high school is better? Well, that one has more parking, so I guess it's better. And here's one in suburban New York, out in the countryside in New York. New York City is exempt from the law in New York. It's 30-20-10 in New York. But they couldn't find 30 acres for a high school in New York if they looked all day. There isn't such a place, so they had to exempt them. And the other thing about schools is that they end up, the landscape companies, the chemical companies, everybody's all over these schools to spend money on anything other than education. And so, you know, this kind of playground is illegal. It's got dandelions on it. That means it's not laced with dangerous herbicides that'll poison your kid and they'll get cancer when they're 27 or something. This has dandelions. But you can't allow that. You got to. So they literally spend hundreds of millions of dollars on school playgrounds, getting rid of the dandelions, or they do it with pavement. This is the James Audubon Middle School in Milwaukee, and the school is it's the highest priority in this school is AC, air conditioning and heating, so you can retain that stuff in the school. Now, the way it used to be done, this is City Hall built in 1893 in Milwaukee. They had a remnant piece of real estate. All the other real estate had been bought up and built on. So they had this little site left, smaller on one end than the other, and they built this beautiful building, which people love, and it just got renovated thanks to my successor. But this is how most municipal buildings are built now, to the standard. You know, they're garages. That's the police department in a suburb called Mequon. They're built on giant property with all this landscaping. You never see anybody walking on it. Now, I gave this slideshow in Brookfield and showed this picture. It's a suburb of Milwaukee. So they took it as a shot, you know. And so they reacted, and they put a bell tower on the building and solved the problem, which I guess I appreciate that. All right. Now, the other villain in this whole thing are the modernists. They're not all bad. I mean, this is Walter Gropius, who did the Bauhaus movement and some really beautiful buildings and also furniture and coffee pots and all kinds of stuff that's really cool. But he didn't like classical architecture because he had gone through World War I, and World War I was caused by the empires, England and Russia and Germany and so forth. And so the very formal architecture. So he came up with a new architecture, he and Corbusier, modernism, and they wanted to kill the old world, to kill the street and change everything and make it modern and up to date. And one of the things he wanted to kill, one of the forms, was the termination of the vista, the classical termination of a vista. In this case, this is in Port Washington, a village of 9,000 people. It was built out, and the street was built out in the 1880s and 90s. And a lot of people that had lived in the Austrian Empire, particularly in Krakow around Poland, but mostly German-speaking people. Anyway, it's a pattern book from Krakow with the St. Mary's Cathedral terminating the street. The standard street for that period of time, the two-rod street, 2 rods from the center lane to the building line, 8-foot sidewalks and 50 feet of pavement, retail on the first floor, apartments above. Now, this went out of favor in the post-war period, but now it's very, very popular real estate. A lot of people love to go there on Sunday morning for brunch and so forth, and it's very lovely. But from the end of World War II, when Walter Gropius fled Germany in 1934, ended up at Harvard. By 1937, he was head of the Harvard School of Design, did a new curriculum, and everybody wants to be like Harvard, of course, except Notre Dame. His curriculum just spread through the whole country. And so after World War II, until about the 1990s, nobody in America built terminated vistas that terminated the vista on a T intersection in America. Believe it or not, nobody, except one guy, and he did it in two places. This is one of them. And that's in Orlando, and the other one's in Anaheim. So you have Sleeping Beauty's Castle terminating the vista with retail on the first floor, apartments above, Mickey, Minnie, Pluto, you know, they're all living in various arrangements. But, you know, this is an old idea. This is a hill town in northern Italy, pen and ink drawing. There's the Chicago Board of Trade on LaSalle Street. The terminated vista increases the value of all the real estate on that street. And you walk down that street, and you feel an extra spring in your step. It's so beautiful. And the movie The Terminators, or whatever it's called, they were just filming there the other day, piling up busted automobiles and creating this big scene of a car accident. Movies are made there. Batman was made there. And 17th century Holland, at the peak of Holland, they built all these beautiful buildings on the canals. So if they could do it in 17th century Holland, why can't we do this today? And the answer is, we can, and we are. There it is, Target. Target now, when you do these lifestyle centers with streets and blocks, They now demand to the developer, they must be on the T intersection, so you have to look at their name when you walk down the street. And it's not quite as elegant as the Board of Trade. You know, it's a little bit on the banal side. But, you know, it's the developers, it's the retail big boxers bringing this beautiful form back. And they'll get better at it over time. And eventually, hopefully, the design schools will stop teaching people not to do this stuff. The other big villain on helping create sprawl was Le Corbusier, who was a Swiss guy from the French-speaking part of Switzerland, who lived in Paris most of his life in Montmartre. That was Gene Kelly's neighborhood in that movie. But anyway, 1922, this is his drawing. And look at that. It looks like an office park you'd see today. But that's meant to be a downtown. That was his vision, the city of tomorrow. And it's grade separated, so you don't have any of those pesky pedestrians in your way when you're driving. You can drive really fast. And this is Crystal City, Virginia, right outside Reagan Airport. And you have, that's exactly Corbusier's vision. You can't walk on that street. It's only for moving vehicles. There's no social life. There's no retail. There is a big metro subway underneath the buildings on the left at Crystal City. If you've ever gone on the metro, you know it. Here's Corbusier, the father of sprawl. It's not some banker in Kansas. It's not some developer from Dallas. It's him. And look at him. Look at those glasses. And they still like him at Harvard. If you go to Harvard, about a third of the students have glasses exactly like that. And this is what he wanted to do to the west bank of the Seine, right near the Ile de Cité, where Notre Dame Cathedral is. That's the Jewish quarter. He was going to turn that into this place where you never had to stop at a stoplight. Everything grade separated, you know, and Robert Taylor Holmes built, but it was in the French, in a French city, and they wouldn't put up with it. So they said no, or no. But we did it in America. That's Pruitt Igoe in St. Louis, built in 55, torn down in 75. It just didn't work. Isolating poor people in tall buildings surrounded by unkempt lawns didn't work. And in Paris, in the suburbs, the banlieue, that's where all the riots were over the last 4 or 5 years, where the Algerians live. You put them in buildings like that and isolate them from everybody else, you can have trouble. But they still keep doing this stuff. This is Zaha Hadid's winning design for the Pritzker Prize, the 2012 Olympic dormitories for New York, if they had won the Olympics. They lost. But they keep coming back to this tower in the park, separating people from the environment around it. The other big modernist, and this guy's still alive, he's 102 years old, Oscar Niemeyer, and he built Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, which is the most boring capital in the world. It's all grade separated, use separated, the housing isn't near the that's the government, the parliament's in the background, there's a freeway. And this is how the streets look underneath, so that you can drive without having to stop at a stoplight. And this is the kind of street that is Main Street in America. This is Kinnikinnick Avenue, Milwaukee, 50 feet of pavement, 8-foot sidewalks, retail and first floor apartments above. All over the Midwest, You go around and measure these streets like Greensburg or anybody. Go out and take a tape measure. You're going to probably find 50 feet of pavement. It's perfect. You have parking, one-row parking. You have just enough room for double parking if you're doing a delivery with a truck, and one moving lane in each direction. And mixed use. You can go to a coffee shop. You can go to a hardware store, bowling alley, liquor store. You can go to the Catholic Church down the street. You can see the tower, but the entrance is right up on the street. And confess right on the same street with the liquor store. Imagine in some new suburban development where you'd actually, it's a miracle if you get more than one building on a block. I mean, it's usually a building with a giant parking lot around it. And why should this be illegal? And it really is. In most communities, it's illegal because of the separate use zoning. You can't build you can't build housing above the stores. Or Fannie and Freddie. I'm no defender of Fannie and Freddie. You want to take it out? Take it out. You need to phase it out so you don't kill the economy in the meantime. But Fannie and Freddie both restrict the amount of non-residential you can have in housing. And so for a city like Evansville, it's really going to be hard to make the numbers work if you have one floor of retail and two or three floors of housing. The retail is going to be more than 20%. So under Fannie, all of your apartments, I mean, all of the condos you build are ineligible for Fannie financing. And so it's like a black hole. Same thing's true with the capital rental program that the federal government has. Discriminates against urban housing. Works fine in New York where the apartments are 30 stories high, one floor of retail. You're not going to hit the limit. But everywhere in the Midwest, Des Moines, Decatur, Illinois, anywhere, Fannie Mae doesn't do urban mixed-use housing at all. And then the banks mimic it because they're all trying to avoid risk. That's why you don't have Main Street. It's not because the market didn't like it. It's because the financing mechanisms and the traffic engineers won't let you do it. Here's downtown Evansville. Perfect. And I'll bet it's 50 feet of pavement with the 8-foot sidewalks. It is that street. And that's the way it looked in a postcard from right before World War II. Here's Toronto. There's a street, Dundas Street, which is plagued with congestion. That's Chinatown. One moving lane in each direction, and the streetcars in that same lane, parking all day, even in rush hour, because the merchants never want to give up that parking. And so it is congested. It's F. But as far as real estate value, it's fabulous. And if it's so bad for congestion, how come the streetcar's full? And how come everybody wants to use the street? The reason it's congested is because people want to be there. If you don't want congestion, I'll show you. I'll show you how you can not have congestion. If your objective is to not have congestion, you can do it. Just follow the regulations. Here's your standard 72-foot arterial with a 100-foot clear zone, 20-foot median so you can have a double pork chop left turn lane. And that's what you get. A void. But it's A. That's A. Another version of A. You can have the pedestrian walking in the gutter. You know, I never understood that. The people say, well, Americans have a love affair with the automobile. Well, yeah, if this is your choice, you can be a criminal suspect walking on the street, or you can be in the pickup truck and be a lawful citizen. I mean, that's the choice we're given by our government. You know, what's wrong with sidewalks? You know, kids can move on the sidewalks. You don't have to drive them everywhere. Or you can play on a sidewalk. You know, what's wrong with that? But this is what we spend all the money on. Over half the money that's spent on roads and streets in this country goes to this one form, the grade separated highway. And it is completely single purpose, mobility. There's no social, unless you're talking about when you get pulled over by a state trooper and you socialize. Good morning. I didn't mean to do it. Okay. So the car industry can't sell cars using the stuff we spend all the money building, so they'll either go in the woods or they'll go to Prague, you know, with the Charles Bridge in the background, which doesn't meet FHWA standards. None of the bridges in Prague meet those standards. Imagine what the Indiana DOT could do for Prague. It's a very congested city, and it is also the richest city per capita of all the former East Bloc countries. We could change that. Now I'm going to show you how you can solve your congestion problems. This city, I'll just tell you, I won't bother quizzing you on it. This is Detroit. In 1946, at the end of the, a little after the end of the war, Woodward Avenue, there's three department stores, Kearns, Crowley's, and Hudson's. Hudson's was the second biggest department store in America, second only to Macy's in New York. Look at streetcars, sidewalks are packed. My parents had their honeymoon there. My dad had been a POW during World War II, a Bataan Death March and all that. He thought Detroit was just fine, so in case you're wondering why they went there. But it was a beautiful city. That's why they went there. And then they started tearing it apart. They had to solve the traffic problem. And so they started ripping the city apart, building lots of highways, and basically moving the economy and the people out of the city. It had 2 million people. Now it has about 770,000 people. That's Hudson's department store 35 years after the war. This is Berlin in May of 1945. Okay, they lost. Remember that? Germans lost World War II. And at the end of the war, about 70% of the buildings in Berlin were either destroyed or damaged so badly they had to be razed. All right, this is Berlin now. This is where the wall ran, right at Potsdamer Platz, the biggest intersection in Berlin. Potsdamer Platz, that was completely empty in 1989. Now it's all built out. It's all back. Let's go to Warsaw. The Nazis took down every building. Hitler said, take every brick apart. There were only a few buildings left. The Bristol Hotel, where I stayed when I was there in December, that was where the German general staff stayed. Beautiful hotel, like the Drake in Chicago. But anyway, everything else torn down. And then that's how it looked. By 1952, it looked that good. Even the communists rebuilt it. Okay, this is Detroit now. 35% of the land that had buildings on it at the end of World War II is now empty. You can look at it at ground level. Those are pheasant. Okay, we won World War II. The most productive city in the world in World War II, not just providing our army, but the British, the Russians, everybody, the whole alliance, was Detroit. Planes, tanks, everything. And a rich city. And now it looks like World War II happened there. Now, it's not just the road building and the zoning and, you know, things, urban renewal and all that stuff. I realize there's other issues that came to play. But I can show you lots of cities that have had issues. Car cities. Torino, Italy, that's a car city, has almost no manufacturing car jobs left. It's the headquarters for Fiat, but they don't make the Fiats there. And it looks fine. It doesn't look like World War II happened there, and World War II actually did happen there. In Milwaukee, this was our African-American really great street, upper-middle-class strutting street, where Duke Ellington would go there after hours, after the downtown club closed. He'd play there till 7 in the morning. This is the way it looked after the Wisconsin Highway Department was done improving it. They just eliminated it. And then all the noise and dirt and smell, so eventually we get these sound barriers. And the steel-reinforced concrete is the best kind of sound barrier. We had a lot of them in Milwaukee. And it's the only surviving technology of the old Deutsche Demokratische Republik. You can see the prototype for the American sound barriers. You know, so if communists like Walter Ulbricht or Erich Honecker came back to life in Berlin, they'd be totally disoriented. The wall's gone. But they could go to San Antonio, Texas. This is Martin Luther King Drive. You know, if Martin Luther King came back to life, he couldn't even legally walk on the street, and they name it after him. You couldn't have a march on it. Maybe that would make it the place he'd want to go. But anyway, this is it's changing because nobody can afford building these things anymore. They don't. If you apply any kind of analysis other than the Schedule A through F congestion index, any other analysis, you wouldn't do it. This is the West Side Highway in New York. It fell down in 1973. They removed it, put in a street. The traffic distributed better. The real estate prices went way up. The whole West Tribeca, Chelsea, Battery, they all came to life as real estate value once they got rid of the freeway. Same thing in San Francisco with the Embarcadero. The boulevard was restored. And in Seoul, South Korea, this is one of the best examples, a freeway the U.S. built after the Korean War. It was taken out, and the whole downtown came to life. And there's the mayor who did it, who's now president of South Korea. And in Milwaukee, without an earthquake, we tore down a freeway. Downtown Milwaukee's doubled its population, not just for that reason, but a lot of reasons. I'm getting very near the end now. This is a wetland or a marsh, and the water engineers have started to figure out these are really valuable. It slows down the water and flooding. It's a great setting for plants and animals. So they don't do the stream pavement so much anymore. They know it's wrong even when they do it. But when we get to traffic engineering, it's still all about the top end of the road hierarchy. And this is a drawing that Wisconsin Department of Transportation uses. Well-planned highway systems enhance safety and traffic flow. Well, both of those are lies, because actually the big roads are much more likely to have fatalities. Anything over 37 miles per hour is very dangerous for pedestrians, and also they don't help traffic flow in an urban setting. They can help, you know, in a rural setting, of course. And so I make the analogy to the street grid is like the wetland. It absorbs traffic. It's an interesting place, a valuable place for developing business and jobs and people to live, interesting, convenient, environmentally high-performing. And if you have a lot of intersection density, you can get a lot of value. All the really rich cities in America have high intersection density. So we're teaching this, and we're not we are kind of a radical group, but the group that we did this book with is not radical at all. The Institute of Transportation Engineers, and there are some really great traffic engineers, and over 90% of the ones who belong to ITE and voted in favor of this, and it's a whole new street system for urban places instead of using the just build to relieve congestion motive. And it also, my book, which I have five copies with, which I'll sell to you for the wholesale price of actually a little under the wholesale price of $20. So that's it on that, and now I get a few minutes to talk about school choice. I'll command that from you whether you like it or not. Okay. When I became mayor, I'd been in the legislature. I'd been a state senator, and it always bothered me that Milwaukee was losing population. I'd always hear about schools. Somebody would have a three-year-old, and they say, I love the city. I'm out of here because my kids got to go to school. If they have money and kids, I don't care if they're black or white, they want it out of the city when their kids were old enough to go to school. So I didn't like that. So I tried different things. Okay, let's have a metropolitan school district. And people in Brookfield said, no. And people in all the suburbs said, no. And if you do that, we'll have a major, major war. And so, anyway, we didn't have the votes if we wanted to do it, and it wouldn't have solved the problem anyway. So I tried that. It didn't work. I finally came to the conclusion. I met with some Catholic parents who were talking to me about parochial, and I'm not Catholic. And they're saying, you know, we pay taxes, and we don't get anything, you know, and we want to live in the city, but, you know, this is really terrible. The system is unfair. And I listened to people in the African-American part of the city who felt like they were getting all the tough duty on the busing. You know, busing was happening where black could be bused from one black school to another black school just to get the aid that the state paid for busing. You know, it was just one thing after another, unhappy parents. And then I started talking to the school choice people that were advocating school choice, and I saw a solution that – why shouldn't a parent be able to choose a good school, whether it's public, private, or parochial? It's their choice. Nobody's forcing them to do it. And what's wrong with supporting religious schools or private schools? Oh, we can't do that. This is America, separation of church and state. Oh, yeah, but what about Notre Dame? What about Marquette? What about Yeshiva University? Those are religious schools, and you can use the GI Bill, Pell Grants. So that argument didn't really make sense. Okay, well, we can't do it. It might undermine the public schools. Okay. Why would it undermine the public schools? If the public schools are so good, people would choose them anyway, right? Well, yeah, but we don't know that for sure. Well, I said, you start asking people that oppose school choice, okay, well, where do you live? One of the biggest opponents of it was an old friend of mine, Greg Squires, who lived in the city, and then as soon as his kids were old enough, they moved to Whitefish Bay. And that name has everything it implies. Anyway, he moved out of town. So I'm talking to him about school choice. And he says, I said, why can't you support school choice? You could have stayed in Sherman Park. And he said, well, at least my kids go to a public school. Oh, okay, that's what matters? So your kid goes to a public school? There's nothing segregating families more than the public education monopoly. And it was hurting the city. I didn't want it to be a city. Because oh, empty nesters are flocking back to American cities. Why only empty nesters? Why not full nesters? Is there something wrong with cities for kids? Kids have parks, they have sidewalks, they have children's museums, they have all kinds of good stuff. You know, if you want to live in the suburbs in a 5-acre lot or something and have a big garden, fine. But you shouldn't have to go there because the schools are bad. You go to Toronto, they have school choice. You go to Winnipeg, Manitoba, they have school choice. You want to live in a city? Live in a city. You want to live in a suburb? They pay for public, private, or parochial schools in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And I supported school choice. We got school choice for non-religious purposes. Then we fought to expand it, and I'm proud to say I led that fight, even though I'm not a Catholic or a Lutheran or a Jew. We have all those schools. The Missouri Synod Lutherans, the most conservative Lutheran denominations, Wisconsin Synod and Missouri Synod, were the only ones with schools left in the inner city. The liberal Lutherans fled to the suburbs, but the ELC. But they're there. And, you know, people come up to me and say, you know, those Missouri Synod Lutherans, they teach creationism. And I say, well, I don't personally, but, you know, I'm a kind of a liberal Presbyterian. I don't quite believe, you know, in the literal, you know, like 6,000 years ago, the universe started and stuff. I don't believe that. But, you know, the good thing about it is those kids that go through that school, they're going to be able to spell creation. And later on, if they want, they could, you know, they can become, you know, somebody more like into science and stuff like me, you know. But they should be able, that's the parents' choice. And people said, yeah, but they might turn them into Lutherans. Okay, what's wrong with being a Lutheran? You know, last time I checked, there weren't a lot of Lutherans in the prison system. You know, there's not a lot of, you know, religion can be a good thing. You know, if you're a devout Christian, you're much less likely to do bad stuff. You know, so, you know, I didn't see the problem with that. So we fought and fought. We got it. It started out slow, but now there's 22,000 kids in the choice program. There's another choice program that all of these things are like battle lines with the school monopoly that opposes it. That's why it's only in Milwaukee, and that's why the school choice program has a cap, income cap at 200%, which is a mistake. As soon as you get a good job, your kids are kicked out of the program. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But, and then there's a private, I mean, a charter program that operates like a voucher program out of University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. They have vouchers. And there's no income cap, but it doesn't allow religious schools. But that one works too. So anyway, Milwaukee's got this diverse thing. We had one Montessori public school, and we had two private Montessori schools. Now there's seven public Montessori schools. There's seven private Montessori schools. There's even a Roman Catholic Montessori school, St. Rose's. They don't call it that because she was an atheist and a communist, Maria Montessori. But they're there, all these choices, Waldorf school, all this stuff. All of a sudden, it's good to be a parent in Milwaukee. Even if you're not eligible for the program, the school's there and you're able to use it. Where, okay, Detroit was protected from school choice. Detroit has the last census, 900,000 people. Let's say it's 800,000 right now. Milwaukee has 600,000 people. We have more kids in our public school, but we have one-third more kids in our public school system than they do, and we have school choice supposedly draining off the kids. No, it's good to be a family and live in Milwaukee. That's what school choice does. And if you had full school choice, even better than our school choice, without income limits, a lot of people would be flocking into Milwaukee. Its population would grow fast in the suburbs. In fact, in the last couple of years, it actually has grown slightly faster than the suburbs. So it's important. And the final thing I'll say about school choice is, you know it yourself, everybody here who has kids, when it came time to choose what school your kid's going to, all you worried about was your own kid. Good example of that, Bill Clinton. Chelsea went to Sidwell Friends. And people criticize him for that. Why didn't you put your kids in Washington's public schools? Because he cared about his kid, and his kid was above politics. You put your kid in the best school. Barack Obama, big supporter of public schools, two daughters in Sidwell. Of course, they have a school choice program now, which unfortunately, I like Barack Obama. I supported him in 08, and I like him for other reasons now. But it really angers me that he supported stopping any new kids, any new poor kids going into Sidwell. They took that away. Though, can you imagine if they tried to do it for the ones that were already there? You go to the parents, well, the teachers union doesn't want you here. And what they think is more important than what you think as a parent. And, you know, some people say to me, well, a lot of parents aren't that good. You know, they have problems. They might even have substance abuse problems, something like that. And they would make bad choices. Well, right now, you know, the public school system in Washington had control of the choices for many years, and now gradually they'll have all that control back again. All the time, they never put any kids in Sidwell. They never made that decision for a kid. They even a bad parent with a criminal record would figure out that Sidwell, yeah, I'll put that down for my kid. They're not going to say, oh, I want a really bad, because I'm a bad parent, I'm going to go for the bad school. A parent cares about their kids. Most do, even the ones that aren't perfect. And to have a system that blocks that choice, that blocks a parent from being able to put their kid in a school they want to go into, unless they're able to move to a rich suburb so there's no poor kids around their kid. I mean, that is sick. That's against everything that was going on in the 1960s with the civil rights movement and all that stuff. And the Republicans love this issue, not because they're idealists, because their enemy is the teachers' union. So it's easy to recruit Republicans to support school choice. And sometimes they even would say stuff to me like, we don't need it in the suburbs. I'd say, well, fine, if you want to support it, whatever your motives are. But I'll tell you, it's a civil rights issue, and I say thank you to the Republicans in Wisconsin who, on a lot of other issues, voted against the city on everything, like transit. But they voted for that. It was a big help. Without them, we wouldn't have made it. And Democrats who have enough courage to stand up for that, for school choice, that's an amazing thing, because they're going to run right into a primary in their next primary election, especially if they're in a really strong Democratic district. But people do it. And the ones who did it the most in Wisconsin were African Americans, Hispanics. They were the ones who stuck their neck out because they cared about the kids. And some of the ethnic, white ethnic Democrats who wanted the Catholic schools to have a shot. But we put the coalition together. It works. It ought to spread around the country. People that care, they should care about kids, not about feeding power pills to the special interest groups that dominate under the current school monopoly system. So with that, thank you very much. I hope I gave you I had one more thing I had to mention for the mayor here. And you had wanted me to I'll think of it later if we have any questions, any time for questions left. Anyway, I was going to answer this. All right, thank you.
That was John Norquist, president and CEO for the Congress for the New Urbanism. Be sure to join us next month on the Economic Club of Indiana. Our guest will be David Johnson, president and CEO of BioCrossroads. Johnson will speak August 18th at the Century Center in South Bend.
ProLiance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.